Okay, tape's rolling. So my name is Dr. Kate Cregan, and I'm here to interview
Kathleen Sophie Wright, knee Chester.
Okay, and the day is Tuesday, the 19th of March, and we're at Kathy's house in Brighton. And the purpose of the interview is part of the larger oral history project being run by the Australian Garden History Society. So just to start out, I'd like to ask you where you were born and where you grew up.
I was born in Mafra in 1939, just before the outbreak of the Second World War. And my family lived on a dairy farm in Gippsland at a place called Glen Maggie, which is almost on the Macalester River in the foothills there. And my paternal grandmother lived with us, and I'm the second in the family. In those days, we didn't have electricity, we didn't have running water, and we had deliveries from a nearby town of groceries once a week. My grandmother liked growing ornamental plants. She had been living there since the 1920s, I think. I do remember she had a snowball tree, a Sasselbrunner rose, and some rather fancy cactus. And she also had a sort of locked up section of her own, which we as children were always wanting to get into this little section of garden. We kept chooks, and there was a vegetable garden. I think because of the lack of water, gardening was something of a struggle there. I lived there till I was 10, did homeschooling for 2 or 3 years, a year at the Glen Maggie Primary School, which had about a dozen students, and 3 of them were from our family. Moved to Hayfield and went for 1 year to the Hayfield Primary School, and then by bus to Sale High School. In Hayfield, my mother grew a lot of vegetables, enjoyed growing vegetables, and we were then on town water. I do remember she used to make a lot of liquid cow manure, which she thought was the most wonderful thing for the vegetables. She also must have mail ordered, I think, some roses. She was keen on roses. Part of my childhood was few interludes were spent in Morwell with my maternal grandparents, and that grandfather was a tremendously good gardener, and he had the most beautiful vegetable garden, raised up beds. He had raspberries and asparagus, which were new to me, and he grew flowers for the house. And in fact, when another baby was coming, my sister and I went there for, I don't know how long, maybe a couple of weeks. And I still have quite a visual picture of Grandfather Green's vegetable gardens. And it was a house where my grandmother's sister was with them. It's a bit of a Millie Molly Mandy family in a way. And she was in charge of arranging flowers for the house. And she had a collection of very nice vases, and would take her all day to cut the flowers and treat them and fiddle around. I guess that kept her out from under people's feet. So that's really my gardening in my formative years. From time to time I remember planting things. Some vegetables produced, some didn't.
So the private part of your grandmother who was living with you, the private part of her garden, why was it private?
Well, it was all trellised off because the children might spoil things.
Touch the plants, pull the leaves.
Something like that, yes, I don't know. And I do remember she had those cactus with the big red, salmon red trumpety flowers that you see around. And, of course, immediately she said we couldn't touch them, pick them. It was a great temptation.
So she wanted to keep her garden looking the way she wanted it to, yes. to look. Okay. So you said you're the second and there was a baby after you. So how many of you were there?
The first in the family is my brother Robert, who was an architect, then me, and then my sister Elizabeth, who did nursing, my brother Arthur, who worked here, there and everywhere. And then the youngest in the family was John, who did go back on the family farm.
Okay. So the farm is still in a part of the family?
Well, cousins. My three brothers have all died in the last few years, but there's a cousin who is on the family farm at Glenmaggie, north of Glenmaggie, really.
And was it dairy or agriculture? Mm. Oh, dairy, yeah, because, yes, that is kind of a dairy area, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And you say you remember planting some vegetables and having a bit of success and a bit of failure.
Probably peas and beans, because seeds seemed to be available. My mother seemed to be able to get her hands on seeds. Perhaps she got them from grandfather. I don't know, but...
No, that's great. So you spent a good deal of your childhood in Gippsland, moving around different places.
And when I finished secondary school at Sale High School, I came to Melbourne and did a science degree.
Okay.
And I never lived in the country again.
What drew you to a science degree?
I guess I found maths accessible, and so it's just sort of what you did, really. And I had a teaching bursary. My brother was a year ahead of me studying architecture, and I think without the teaching bursary the family wouldn't have been able to cope financially with two of us, although there was never any question of girls not going on to do higher education. It was just accepted that that's what everybody did. There was no distinction made about that.
So what period are we talking about there?
56.
Okay.
Started at Melbourne in 57.
The birth of television.
Yes. The Melbourne Olympics. I was in year 12 for Melbourne Olympics. Yes.
Rock and roll.
Yes.
And how did you get by if you're coming from the country?
I was resident at what was in those days called Women's College. It's now University College at Melbourne. Mm-hmm. Melbourne was the only university, so you didn't make a choice. Monash opened in the early 60s, and I'd finished by then.
Yep. And how did you find university life?
Well, living in college was fantastic, and I still have many friends from my college days. So it's a bit different, really, from students who don't live in college, because you do have that whole community and social life.
And was there any... I know now those colleges have quite tended gardens. Was there any sort of...
There wasn't anything much in those days. I did choose botany in first year, partly because my mother had studied pharmacy in the late 20s, and somewhere there was a book where she had these beautiful pastel drawings from her botany classes, and... I think that's what I thought. Well, that's what botany is. Well, of course, we didn't draw beautiful pictures at all, but it was very interesting. And of course, there was the systems garden there at the back of the botany school in those days where they had experimental plots and things. And Professor Turner was the dean then, I think, of botany. But I only did it for 1 year because teaching, you know, that wasn't something you could major in. You had to have a mixed, because I was on teaching bursary, you had to have a mixed range of subjects. So I just did that for 1 year.
So, yeah, the aim of the teaching bursary was to make you a high school teacher at some point. Yeah.
And to have a range of science, as well as maths, a range of science subjects to teach science.
No, that's true. You wouldn't be able to teach botany in high school even today.
No.
Biology, yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. But you didn't stick with it only for that reason? If you'd been able to specialise in botany, with it, do you think you would have stuck with it?
Look, I don't know. I don't know.
That's interesting. So when you then finished your degree?
I was teaching at, my first teaching was at Canterbury Girls High School. In fact, I had applied to teach at country schools, but I was sent there. And And I married halfway through my first year and continued to teach at Canterbury Girls High School. My husband and I lived above the National Bank in Chapel Street, Paran, and there was no land or anything,
no gardening
there. And I was pretty busy with the teaching because I immediately had year 12 classes, so there was a lot of preparation, a lot of correction, and so I didn't have anything really to do with gardens then, and we went to England for a year in 1966, 5 years after we were married, and we didn't have children then, and I worked as a teacher and we travelled around like everybody did in the 60s, and it really... English, I do remember English parks, but again, I wasn't really aware of famous English gardens then. After that, I did become much more interested in gardens and English gardens and had quite a lot of the sort of standard English garden books in the late 60s, early 70s. Then I had children, I had three daughters. And in 1967, we moved to Brighton, and at that time, there were extreme water restrictions. So you saved the baby's bathwater to just put on a couple of plants that you wanted to save. It was quite a big suburban block, and there was an apricot tree and a pear tree and a lemon tree, all well established, and fruited quite well. There was an old hen house in the corner, no hens. I can't remember. There were a few old roses, can't remember much out of it. So I had, my children were born between 67 and 70. So they were busy years.
Not a lot of time for gardening.
No, and then when the youngest was 5, I think, I suddenly decided I would go back to work, and Brighton Technical School was the nearest school that I could walk to, so that's where I was for 3 years, and I don't remember too much about being involved with the garden then. I mean, clearly we had lawn and the lawn was cut, and, you know, we kept the weeds out and so on. And in 1980, my husband died. The children were, two were at primary school and one had just started high school, and that was quite a sudden thing. He had an aneurysm and...
Oh, I'm sorry.
And so it was quite sudden. At that stage, I had moved to be teaching at Star of the Sea in Garden Vale, and I had the most amazing support from the lay staff, and there were only about three nuns on the staff then, but there was a woman who was the principal, most amazing woman I've ever met, really, and they were extremely kind and extremely supportive to me, and I stayed there then for 20 years. So then after, so that was the early 80s, in that year, another friend of mine called Laurie Lawrence, who was also a garden history person, had been a social worker till that date, and she had retrained as a landscaper. So she, putting her social work practice and her landscape together, came to me and said, we need to fix your garden. And so she redesigned the garden and did some work, and we worked side by side. And between the staff at Star of the Sea and my friend Laurie and my garden, the next 10 years ran, all things considered, very smoothly. And I do think that my daughters, who have grown, got families, got good jobs and everything, I think those 10 years, which were significant for them without their father, we owe a lot to gardening, and we owe a lot to the staff at Star of the Sea, really. And because then I was very enthusiastic about the garden, I was a bit given to burning rubbish, but...
Who wasn't?
but it did mean, I mean, I needed really to be home for the girls, and I always, you know, I never felt that I was trapped or anything like that, because I always had lots and lots to do in the garden, and I didn't grow I grew tomatoes, but I didn't grow any vegetables really. Laurie would call by and use her social work skills and, you know, praise me up and keep me going with this garden project. So it was marvellous, really marvellous. And I'd also joined Garden History in 1980, but didn't do a lot of things. And I was working for another 20 years and mostly teaching senior students. So I didn't go to garden history conferences in those 20 years. The time of the year just wasn't right. But I retired in 2000, and from then on I went to every garden history conference and loved them. So I got back to gardening.
So you obviously had very keen gardeners in your childhood.
Yes.
But then this long period where it was not a focus in your
life. Right, probably from the late 50s till 1980 it wasn't a focus, no.
Okay. And you say that Laurie helped you by helping you landscape your garden. Did you get hands-on with that, or were there people came in and helped? Because when I think of landscaping...
At that stage, Victor, who later became her business, her garden partner and her life partner, actually, but I think at that stage, Victor did some work for her, and I remember he came and moved... There were a lot of rocks, sandstone rocks had been put on the site, and they were arranged around the edges of the garden in an extremely ugly fashion. So they all had to be sunk down to the level of the lawn to go disappear them, sort of make edges for the lawn and a pond. And Victor must have helped with some of that. But quite a lot we did ourselves. I mean, I was only 40. I've got a lot of strength and energy at that age.
Absolutely. And were you guided by her in what went in?
Or? Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes, I didn't. I didn't know much about plants then. I could recognise all the sort of common garden plants, but I didn't really know anything much about plants. Mind you, there's so much to learn about plants, you never, ever know as much as you'd like to know, I don't think. Yes, and she helped me choose plants, and we restructured everything. And there'd been a sort of bed in the middle with stones around it that had a grapevine, so we took that out. I used to cut the lawns in those days. So...
Powered mower or
a hand mower then?
Good exercise.
Good exercise, yes. And the lawn had always been in the back of that block, and it was good buffalo lawn, so that was fine. It was easy to do. There was a huge fig tree. Typical of this, of most suburban areas in Melbourne, I think, to have those fruit trees. My daughter, when she got into her house at Hyatt, she had a huge apricot tree. Mm. And I didn't have, crab apples were also very popular. I didn't have a crab apple, but there was a beautiful one next door, the common one with the pink and white blossom. They were very popular at that time. So were fritinias, and I remember digging out a huge fritinia. I hated it, but I don't mind them now. At the time, I felt it didn't pull its weight, you know, just a leafy thing. I was all wanting everything to have flowers or fruit.
And did you make use of the fruit? I mean,
yes. Yes, I. With the figs, there was a marvellous recipe for a sort of crystallising them.
Oh, yes.
So you boiled them in syrup and then you put them out in the sun to dry and all that. Used to do a lot of that with the figs and give them away. I didn't... The apricots, I would make apricot jam. Pears, I'd just stew.
I've just got through bottling some pears.
Have you?
Yes. Okay. And were you drawn to... I mean, I can see you've got floral pictures on your walls. Were you drawn to having arrangements in your house, like your great
always,
aunt?
Always, yes. And I still do. You know, I still always have flowers. Yes.
Did she teach you, or did you pick
I think we just watched her.
Right.
They had quite a collection of John Campbell pots, and I've got some of those now, which were good for arranging flowers in there, those greeny-coloured Tasmanian pots. And they had a house with sort of three living rooms, and they all had mantelpieces. So the mantelpieces were perfect for putting these troughs with flowers. They were lovely. Yes, I do have. That aunt was also very... crafty. She taught my sister and I to knit and crochet, and always had a bag of coloured wool that was like a beautiful thing to us, because from wartime and living on the farm, there wasn't a lot of colour in anything. You know, clothes were pretty plain, but at Morwell there always seemed to be this colour in a way that we didn't have on the farm.
So going back to your house in Brighton that you bought with your husband, is that the house you lived in up until you came here?
Okay. Across the road from here at number 10, and I lived there for 52 years, I think.
Okay.
And it was a big old weatherboard, and it was in a big block of land. So, as my daughters pointed out to me, it was way too much space for me to be occupying. Now it's got six units on it, so it probably houses 18 people. They're all three-bedroom units.
True, but the garden obviously is gone.
The garden's gone. And what surprised me when they excavated over there, below the topsoil, not very far down, I reckon less than a metre, It's that bright orange sand that you see in the Australian garden at Cranbourne. All the way down. Because they dug it up out the block completely to make an underground car park.
Okay.
So not a light colour, that real rich red sand. Just interesting.
So there's something about the geology is
Along the
similar
coast here.
Along the coast. Okay. Mm. So you say that Laurie also introduced you to the society.
Yes.
And that you... What did you do in the years before you became very active?
I worked. And what did I do? I used to do some gardening around at the Star of the Sea, plant things around there and so on. They had a full-time gardener, but we used to do a bit there. Honestly, I don't know. I didn't have much to do with... I mean, we used to go into the botanic gardens from time to time and walk around and look at things. I don't even know if the... At one stage, I was a selector with Laurie for the Open Garden Scheme, and that was before... That was when I was still working, so maybe that was in the 90s,
okay,
when the girls had left home. And then Laurie stopped doing it, which sort of left me a bit stranded. I did it for a couple more years, but that was... I really didn't know enough to be doing that without her there as well.
So what did that involve?
Well, going to gardens and trying to decide if they were suitable for the... garden scheme, and if they weren't, telling the person why they weren't, and if they were, recommending them to whoever was in charge of the scheme at the time, Wendy Ritchie, I think, and you had to write the little paragraph that went in the book underneath.
Okay, so people self-promoted, it was...
Often, yes, yep. Or sometimes people would... People in garden history would look over the fence and see a garden and say, look, there's a garden at such and such a place. Or people who were in the scheme, and they'd say, knock on their door and see if they're interested. So that we did a bit of that. Sometimes it worked, sometimes they weren't. I'd sort of forgotten all that.
Sorry, I find that a little bit amusing. You're sort of door-knocking people.
And saying, well, are you interested in being in the Open Gardens game? I don't know. I wonder when it started. Maybe in the late 80s, early 90s.
Well, that's something somebody could check through the
society's
archives.
Yes, when it started. I think I did it for 2 or 3 years. It was certainly when I was still working, so it was perhaps in the 90s. And I always looked at gardens, so if I were walking up and down the street, you know, I could tell you what all their gardens in Hassling Street looked like. Pretty much a lot of similarity in suburban gardens at that time, and not the... Well, there's two things that have changed. There is the designer garden, so they're much more designed than they were, and the other thing is the clipping of hedges and so on that you see now that gives shape to gardens, and I think that's to do with the development of electric clippers and tools.
Oh yes,
that make it so much easier to keep things clipped. Maybe it's a bit on the wane now. Maybe it's had its day, all that clipping, but there's still a fair bit, and it can work well with mixed plantings, I think. I quite like that.
Going back to the society, you said that you were... We became a member in the early 80s. Were you a founding member? Or
no,
shortly after?
No, just
okay.
Me.
Mm. Yep, okay. And you've obviously taken part in the selection of gardens for
the open gardens. Was in those days.
So, and you also said that you became active once you retired.
Yes, yeah, so in 2000.
So what was the first thing that you did that was
I joined the Victorian active? Branch and I became treasurer of the Victorian branch. And after, I can't remember exactly how long, but then I became the national treasurer for a few years. When I was on the Victorian branch, Pamela Jelly was the president, and we organised the Geelong Conference. And then John Dwyer was the president, and we organised the Ballarat Conference. And the important thing about that, John Dwyer as president thought that everyone in the society should be able to attend the annual conference. And for many years, the conference had not taken more than 200 members, and I'm guessing the society had about 1,200 members, so there were always people who couldn't get a place at the conference. So for Ballarat Conference, we set that at 300 or a bit more than 300. We found an auditorium. It was flat, so it wasn't ideal, but still we did have 300 people attend the conference, and that seemed to leave us without a waiting list. So John Dwyer was national president for some time, and he was an excellent president. You know, he had a very clear views about the society. He had a lot of experience with National Trust, so he was the right person for the job. And Pam Jelly and I, on the Victorian committee, we arranged lots and lots of garden tours, many to the Western District, because Pam had grown up there, and some to Gippsland. We had day tours and weekend tours. We did lots and lots of tours, which people enjoyed. They were good. We always liked to have a bus tour because we liked our audience to be captive, and we could give them lots of information for what to look out for. Some members preferred self-drive, but Pam and I liked to get them so we could talk to them and point out all sorts of... Pam was absolutely marvellous too. She's got a terrific sense of garden history. In fact, she really is a garden historian, so she always prepared excellent notes and always had a lot about the history of the gardens. And I was treasurer, and we made quite a bit of money, which was good. And one of the first things when I was treasurer, Helen Botham had written notes on Latrobe's garden, and Richard Heathcliff, had suggested to Helen that she publish this in the form of a book. He at the time, I think, was working at Rip and Lee for the National Trust. And Helen approached the Victorian branch to finance half it, with Latrobe Society financing the other half. And I do remember it was $9,000, and the Victorian branch had about $12,000 in their bank account. I was very new to treasurer, but I thought this was exactly what we should do. And we did finance half that. And Helen and her husband, John, looked after the copies and sold them at every opportunity. And Latrobe Society also took half the copies. I can't remember how many. And eventually all the money got paid back, because eventually we sold them all. And very recently, in fact, I think last year, that publication's been reprinted. Oh. And it's always on sale. I think it's always on sale. I don't know if it's still in garden history lists, but it's always on sale through the National Trust or at Latrobe's Cottage when it's open. So that was, you know, was a nice thing to be associated with, and it was long-term, I would say, a great success. At that time too, the Society produced pamphlets for various historic gardens. There were quite a few of them. Different people wrote them, and they were an A3 folded, so 4 A4 sides with photographs and notes, and they were sold for a very small amount, $2 or $3, I think. There were a lot of those. I can't immediately tell you which gardens. Belmont at Geelong was one.
Yep.
And some of the Walling Gardens, but I can't remember now which one. A number of times we visited Port Coy, which was in the Western District, which is a very fine example of a Walling Garden. But it was a farming property, and when water was short, and there were years when water was very short, they said, well, we have to feed the stock, we can't put water on the garden. And that was the case with a number of country properties. We had tours to the Western District where we incorporated the Botanic Gardens, Colac Botanic Gardens, designed by Guilfoyle, I think. Warrnambool Botanic Gardens, of course Geelong Botanic Gardens. It was then a terrific program, but I think prior to that, Victorian Branch had a terrific program, and subsequently they still have a very good program. So in that way, that period wasn't special, but we did have a lot of great things.
Your contribution wasn't just as treasurer. I mean, you also organised a lot of that.
Yes, yeah. And it was the days, I think, before you had to have a commercial kitchen, so we always cooked the morning and afternoon tea ourselves, and it was a good fundraiser really to do that. We generally had the lunches catered for. We like to, if possible, find in the country something like a school committee or the Red Cross or one of those charities to cater for the lunches. And of course, when the restrictions came in on not being able to cater unless you had a commercial kitchen, I don't know when that was, but that made it difficult to use those country people. It must have been somewhere between about 2000 and 2010, I think, just guessing. But yes, it was good to involve local, and usually the garden owners would know someone on the school committee or on the Country Women's or Red Cross or whatever.
Yes, I was going to say Country Women's Association was well known for catering such things. My grandmother was a part of that,
right?
Very often.
Yes, yes, and it was it was good because they got the money, we got a lovely lunch, and it worked for everyone.
So you were branch treasurer. Did you say you also did something at the national level?
I was the national treasurer for 5 or 6 years.
And what did that involve?
At that stage, Jackie Comadius was the executive officer in the office in the Botanic Gardens, and it did not involve a lot for me because Jackie was very, very capable. In those days, there were cheques. The cheques had to be countersigned, and Jackie would have all the cheques written ready. I would sign them. Now, I followed Mel Fall as treasurer on the national one, and so after I signed them, Jackie would take them to the herbarium where Fran Fall volunteered. She would take them home, Mel would countersign them, and then I'd come back to Jackie and she'd post them. I mean, compared with online banking, it's something, isn't it?
Yes.
and then at the time of when there was a conference, we usually gave the conference committee access to a bank account, and Jackie, all of the applications for the conference went through the office, and Jackie banked all of that money and accounted for all that money and gave me a neat summary. And then the people who would run this account up to the conference and shortly afterwards to tidy everything up, and then that account would be closed. So once a year there had to be, by the time I did, when I did the branch one, it was a ledger with everything done with pen on paper, and we didn't have to have an audit, but we had to have someone check it and say that it was all right. Graham Capel, who been involved a bit over the years, used to often check it for me. But when it was national, they had auditors, and it would all go off to the auditors, and the auditors actually prepared the summary that went into the AGM, and you just wrote a few paragraphs about what had been happening. So it wasn't really arduous, but mainly because Jackie was so well organised and such a good support made it straightforward. And I was a little then I was not on a committee at all when the in 2017 when they had the conference in Melbourne. I was on the committee then, but Mel and Fran Forbes did most of the work for that conference.
So you also said that you travel quite a bit now, that like when you were mentioning living in England, that you weren't really... Gardens weren't on your radar at that stage.
Not really. We did travel a lot, you know, at every opportunity in England, Ireland, Wales, Scotland, all of that. We went to the... We had friends in France at that stage, Australians in France. We travelled there. We went to Moscow in 1966, which was a bit out there, on a bus tour from London. And Scandinavia. I've never been to Spain. I'm sorry, I've never been to Spain. I've been to Portugal, not to Spain.
One for the list. One for the list.
I think I don't know that I can. Anyway, you can always look at books and things. So I think it was really after my husband died that I must have got into the gardening books and the reading a lot about English gardens and things as well, because we lived mostly in London in 1966, and there were lovely squares and small gardens and. Kensington Gardens were just at the end of the street, but I didn't really have enough knowledge then to know what was what. Probably still don't.
So in your retirement, does that mean that you visited gardens, like when your focus did move towards historical gardens, and what was your favourite kind of garden and where would you find it?
Gosh, I don't think I could say I had a favourite one. I couldn't say I had a favourite one. I have, since I retired, which was 2000, I have travelled a lot, and the focus has almost always been on gardens. I did go to America with a friend who was not interested in gardens, and we were about 8 or 9 days in New York, and she was interested particularly in libraries and historic buildings, and I think I saw almost every small and large garden in Manhattan, and they were marvellous. You know, it was a real eye-opener. There were all sorts. And they had community gardens then. It must have been early in 2000. They had community gardens, which were interesting. I've been to Japan to look at gardens, and they're all different again, but wonderful in their way. In China, some of the traditional, one of my daughters and her husband lived and worked in China, so I visited China a few times. I've got a few things on my wish list, but I don't know that I'll get to them. There's a weekend in the middle of June when gardens are open in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them, you go through the canal houses to see the garden.
Yep.
And they're fairly close together. And as far as I know, that's been happening probably at least 10 years. But when I've been to Europe, I've never been quite in the right place to get there in the middle of 18th and 19th, that weekend near to there, 4 days or something. So that's one thing that I haven't done I'd like to do. Last year I was in Belgium, again looking at gardens with Sandra McMahon, who's a landscaper. And that was interesting because there's quite a move there now for, what do you call it, like dry gardening, free-range gardening. And in Belgium, and I understand also in France now, that the verges and nature strips are just allowed to grow at will for the whole of the summer, and they just cut them down at the end of summer to increase biodiversity. I've been to, I haven't been to lots of English gardens. I've been to the Sissinghurst, I've been to a lot in London of parks and gardens and, you know, places. I've been to Sissinghurst, can't remember what else.
And have you done that off your own bat, or have you done it as part of tours, or a bit of both?
A bit of both. Yes,
okay.
Yes. I most recently I've done tours. 10 years ago, I had a friend, who I know said who, you know, liked libraries and things. I travelled with her. I've done a few tours with Tricia Dixon. I've done Sicily with Tricia Dixon. That was marvellous. What else have I done? I've done a lot of country Australian ones with Tricia, Cooma, South Australia, Goulburn and that area. I've done several Tasmanian ones. Yes, so, but this is mostly in the last 20 years, all of my garden visits.
What draws you to garden history?
I suppose the garden element. And, well, the history is my grandmother that lived with us, I think she was probably born in about 1880 something, and she and her, they lived at Seaton in Gippsland. She had 5 sisters and 1 brother, and only 2 of them married, and one of them was a published writer, which was, you know, quite something. And they were very interested in history, focused particularly on British history.
Mm-hmm.
Really held quite a colonist view of Australia. But I guess so that there was always that sort of interest, and, you know, she'd talk, because we were 5 of us fairly close together. She used to read us stories and tell us stories. My mother reckoned she wasn't always red hot on the facts, but she had all sorts of stories. So we knew about the princes in the tower and things like that. So that history, and as I say, she was gardening. So I suppose, yes, I am to some extent interested in history.
What would you say that your focus is actually on the garden here and now?
I think it is more, yes. Now, I think it is.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, mainly because there's so much happening. Although, you know, a group of us from Garden History work at the Country Women's in Lancel Road,
mm-hmm.
Fran and Mel and Pamela Jelly. And Ruth Caper works there and Jocelyn Backhouse. And that started because we wanted somewhere for lunch when we had the Melbourne conference in 2017 that would accommodate nearly 300 people, I suppose, with some cover in case it rained. And we asked the countrymen if we could go there, and they said yes, and the garden was very overgrown, although it had been a well laid out garden in the past, and you know, lawns, and there were a lot of bluestone walls and pond, and it was certainly in the style of Edna Walling. Tim Gatehouse says there's no real evidence that it's Edna Walling, but it's very much in that style. So it had the structure. It had pergolas with the wisteria big oak tree up at the top. It had all that structure, but it was full of invasive species and weeds. And so that was Jackie Cormadius. Then we tidied up a bit for the conference, and then two or three of us went on working there. I think when we first started, we used to go once a month, but now we go every Wednesday morning, and the whole garden is in very good shape. And we've tried to keep the sort of sense of Walling, but go for dry climate plants as far as possible. We try not to water at all now. And, I mean, the roses, wisteria, the trees, they all survive. And we've mostly got rid of the Wandering Jew and the Cacrosmia and something else. Oh, onion weed. So and that spider plant, the thing called spider plant, big fleshy tubers and a sort of nondescript white flower.
Yep.
Very invasive species. Anyway, we've mostly dug those out, and we're pretty pleased with ourselves.
So is that the CWA building where women could come down from the country and stay at?
Okay. And they have not had that B&B open since COVID, but I understand they're about to open any minute. Great service for country people because it was inexpensive and it's right on the Toorak tram line. Good spot. And of course they do an enormous amount of catering for all sorts of things. Victorian Racing Club, Government House, Melbourne Show, Melbourne Flower and Garden Show. Heaps.
Sorry. That's me. Okay. So I think I've got a really sort of broad question, because I think probably from my point of view, got quite a lot of information. You might still have things that you want to say, but a broad question about gardening and what it means to you. What does gardening in general mean to you?
I think it's a visual thing, and it's sort of shapes and colours, really. I'm not really a vegetable grower.
So shape and form and...
And yes, I think it's the sort of visual impact of a garden that's important to me, yes.
It gives you a feeling of satisfaction.
Yes, joy. Yes, and joy, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So, let me see. Is there anything else? In the time that you've been associated with the AGHS, do you feel that it's changed?
Not a lot, I don't think.
Okay.
They're a constant, they have ever since I've belonged, well, since 2000 anyway, since I've been active, there's always been the question of attracting younger members. And is the name perhaps not attractive to younger people? But I think most organisations that have been manned by volunteers for a long time have the same problem now. And I think, I mean, it's a good thing that women have careers and work and And they say they're not available to volunteer. I think that's just a fact of life. So I think, you know, it's always going to pretty much be retirees who do most of the work for voluntary organisations.
Can you see ways in which you think things could move forward or change? Do you see need for change, I guess I'm asking?
I expect there is need for change if you want to keep the society going, and so you need some renewal. But I've got no idea how to do it, because I have three daughters who all garden and know a bit about gardening, but they also have very big jobs and families. So, you know, they wouldn't have time to be involved with anything voluntary, really. They've been involved with their schools, their children's schools, briefly, but otherwise they don't have time to do any voluntary work.
Gardens do take time.
Yes.
I'm finding out. Okay, so do you feel like you've passed on your connection to gardens and gardening to your descendants?
Well, they garden, but I don't think they feel the same way. My youngest daughter does. She's not bad, you know. She's knows a bit. She's single. She knows a bit. And when she was at the Country Women's recently, she said to me, "You should take that out of there. It's way too yellow." I thought, oh, wow, fancy that. So she has some sort of sense of joy about gardening and plants, and she loves her plants in a way. The other two, not so much. I've got quite nice gardens, but they're too busy to be too
And you obviously involved. Have grandchildren.
Yes.
Have you gardened with them?
When they were little, I did. You know, when they were sort of preschool, I used to have them digging up and planting. In a small way, some of them do a bit. One of the girls does a bit. They all still live at home. Some of them in their 20s. One of them does a bit of planting things in the herbs and garlic and things in the vegetable patch. And the other, one of the girls who's moved out of home, she's moved out of home. She lives in Geelong. And she set herself up a nice little herb garden, that was all. not much, but they're young. They're young and they're busy.
Do you miss having your big garden?
Well, the Country Women's has filled the void for me, because I sometimes pop along during the week if I've got a few hours to spare, and I think I need to get out of here. So that's been marvellous for me to fill the void. There's volunteer gardeners at Ripon Lea and at Como, I think. So there are places where you can volunteer to garden if you don't have your own.
Because I noticed coming in that maybe there's more sort of open area behind this building, but just coming into the building, there didn't seem to be
There's
very
a big
much.
Courtyard in the middle.
Okay.
Mm.
Okay.
And otherwise just what you see in the front, mostly clivias.
And is it encouraged to potter around there, or is that done professionally?
No, that's done professionally. I understand there's a history of disputes about the courtyard garden. But since I've been here 5 years, it's very much off limits to residents.
Competing interests and styles.
Apparently,
and,
yes.
Okay. Okay, so is there anything else that you think you'd like to say? Anything I haven't drawn out?
No, I don't think so. Gardening's been, in those middle years, I didn't garden, but really, for the last 45 years, It's been a great bank stop for me, I must say. Yeah. Mm. And it makes it, and it does make a great focus for travelling. I've got other friends where restaurants, food and all that's their focus. Well, that's pretty nice to go hand in hand with gardens too. No, I think it's a great thing to do, to garden.
Okay. Well, then I'd just like to thank you for taking part, and I'll explain to you once I've turned the recording off that what, if you've forgotten something, that how that can be added to what we've done here.
Okay.
Okay, but I'll turn it off now.
I'll get us some lunch.
Thank you.